even less likely to tell the truth. Every organization faces this challenge, no matter how flat it tries to be. At Facebook, we work hard to be non-hierarchical. Everyone sits at open desks in big open spaces. No offices, cubes, or partitions for any of us. We hold a company-wide Q&A every Friday where anyone can ask a question or make a comment. When people disagree with decisions, they post to the company-wide Facebook group. Still, I would be an idiot, or not telling myself the truth, if I thought that my coworkers always felt free to criticize me, Mark, or even their peers. When psychologists study power dynamics, they find that people in low power positions are more hesitant to share their views and often hedge their statements when they do. This helps explain why, for many women, speaking honestly in a professional environment carries an additional set of fears. Fear of not being considered a team player. Fear of seeming negative or nagging. Fear that constructive criticism will come across as just plain old criticism. Fear that by speaking up, we will call attention to ourselves, which might open us up to attack. A fear brought to us by that same voice in the back of our heads that urges us not to sit at the table. Communication works best when we combine appropriateness with authenticity, finding that sweet spot where opinions are not brutally honest, but delicately honest. Speaking truthfully without hurting feelings comes naturally to some and is an acquired skill for others. I definitely needed help in this area. Fortunately, I found it. When Dave was at Yahoo, he attended a management training program taught by Fred Kaufman, a former MIT professor and author of Conscious Business. Dave hates training of any kind, and the human resources team at Yahoo had to force him to attend the two-day session. When he came home after the first day, he surprised me by describing the training as not too bad. By the end of the second day, he started quoting Fred and making observations about our communication. I was in shock. This guy must be good. So I called Fred, introduced myself, and said, "I don't know what you do, but I want you to do it for my team at Google." Fred showed up at Google, and his teachings changed my career and my life. He is one of the most extraordinary thinkers on leadership and management I have ever encountered. Many of the concepts discussed in this chapter originated with him and reflect his belief that great leadership is conscious leadership. I learned from Fred that effective communication starts with the understanding that there is my point of view, my truth, and someone else's point of view, his truth. Rarely is there one absolute truth. So people who believe that they speak the truth are very silencing of others. When we recognize that we can see things only from our own perspective, we can share our views in a non-threatening way. Statements of opinion are always more constructive in the first person I form. Compare these two statements. "You never take my suggestions seriously." And, "I feel frustrated that you have not responded to my last four emails, which leads me to believe that my suggestions are not that important to you. Is that so?" The former can elicit a quick and defensive, "That's not true." The latter is much harder to deny. One triggers a disagreement. The other sparks a discussion. I wish I could always maintain this perspective in all my communications. I don't, but I continue to try. Truth is also better served by using simple language. Office speak often contains nuances and parentheticals that can bury not just the lead, but the entire point. Comedies like Office Space ring true for a reason. People fear insulting others, especially the boss, so they hedge. Rather than stating, "I disagree with our expansion strategy," they say, "While I think there are many good reasons why we are opening this new line of business, and I feel confident that the management team has done a thorough ROI analysis, I am not sure we have completely thought through all of the downstream effects of taking this step forward at this time. Huh? With all of these caveats, it's hard to decipher what the speaker actually thinks. When communicating hard truths, less is often more. A few years ago, Mark Zuckerberg decided to learn Chinese. To practice, he spent time with a group of Facebook employees who were native speakers. One might think that Mark's limited language skills would have kept these conversations from being substantively useful. Instead, they gave him greater insight into what was going on in the company. For example, one of the women was trying to tell Mark something about her manager. Mark didn't understand, so he said, "Simpler, please." Then she spoke again, but he still didn't understand, so he had to ask her to simplify further. This happened a few more times. Eventually, she got frustrated and just blurted out, "My manager is bad." She was still speaking Chinese, but simply enough that Mark understood. If more people were this clear, the performance of many organizations would improve dramatically. The ability to listen is as important as the ability to speak. From the time my siblings and I were very young, whenever we had arguments, our mother taught us, or more like forced us, to mirror each other, which means restating the other person's point before responding to it. For example, one day my sister and I were fighting over a lollipop. "Cheryl ate the last lollipop," Michelle screamed. "But she had a lollipop yesterday and I didn't," I screamed back, making an excellent point. My mother sat us down facing each other. I was not allowed to explain how gravely inequitable the lollipop allocation was until I acknowledged my sister's feelings. "Michelle, I understand that you are upset because I ate the last lollipop and you wanted it." As painful as this was at the time, reflecting someone's viewpoint clarifies the disagreement and becomes a starting point for resolution. We all want to be heard, and when we focus on showing others that we are listening, we actually become better listeners. I now do this with my children, and while they probably dislike the process as much as I did when I was their age, I love hearing my son explain to my daughter, "I'm sorry you're upset because you lost at Monopoly, but I'm older than you, so I should win." Not bad for a 7-year-old. Although Fred would caution my son to take out the "but" and everything after, since it tends to deny the preceding statement. Imagine someone saying, "I really like you, but..." Being aware of a problem is the first step to correcting it. It is nearly impossible to know how our actions are perceived by others. We can try to guess what they're thinking, but asking directly is far more effective. With real knowledge, we can adjust our actions and avoid getting tripped up. Still, people rarely seek enough input. A few years ago, Tom Brokaw interviewed me for a piece on Facebook. Tom is a magnificent interviewer, and I felt that I stumbled through some of my answers. After we wrapped, I asked him how I could have done better. He seemed surprised by my question, so I asked him again. He then told me that in his entire career, I was only the second person to ask him for feedback. The strategy of soliciting input broadly was first demonstrated for me by Robert Rubin, Secretary of the Treasury when I joined the department in 1996. During my first week there, I was invited to a meeting on restructuring the IRS. About 10 senior staffers were sitting at the table when we entered. Since I knew nothing about the topic, I took a seat in the back corner of the room. Yep, not even close to the table. Toward the end of the meeting, Secretary Rubin suddenly turned and asked, "Cheryl, what do you think?" I was stunned silent. My mouth opened, but nothing came out. When he saw how shocked I was, Secretary Rubin explained why he had put me on the spot. "Because you're new and not fully up to speed on how we do things, I thought you might see something we were missing." Apparently not, in my case. But Secretary Rubin sent a powerful message to all of us about the value of soliciting ideas from every corner. Literally. Secretary Rubin was also aware of the dangers of blindly following leaders, or in his case, being blindly followed. Before becoming Treasury Secretary, Rubin served as co-chairman of the board of Goldman Sachs. At the end of his first week as co-chairman, he noticed that Goldman was heavily invested in gold. He asked someone why the firm had taken such a big position. The startled employee answered, "That was you, sir." "Me?" Rubin replied. Apparently, the day before he had been taking his initial tour of the trading floor and commented, "Gold looks interesting." This got repeated as, "Rubin likes gold," and someone spent millions of dollars to please the new boss. More than a decade later, I experienced my own Rubin likes gold moment. When I joined Facebook, I faced a dilemma. I needed to bolster the business side of the company while respecting its unconventional culture. Most corporations love PowerPoint presentations, so I encouraged people not to prepare them for meetings with me, but instead to come with a simple list of topics. I repeated this frequently, but every meeting seemed to include a detailed PowerPoint presentation anyway. After more than 2 years of frustration, I announced that although I hated making rules, I was making one. No more PowerPoint in my meetings. A few weeks later, as I was getting ready to speak to our global sales team, Kirsten Neville Manning, a skilled human resources leader at Facebook, came to find me. Kirsten thought I should know that everyone in Europe was upset with me. Really? I angered an entire continent? She explained that client meetings were very difficult without PowerPoint and asked why I would make such a stupid rule. I explained that I had intended the rule to apply only to presentations to me. But just as the Goldman team heard, "Gold equals good," the Facebook team heard, "PowerPoint equals bad." I got on stage in front of our entire sales team and apologized for the misunderstanding. I also let them know that if they hear a bad idea, even one they believe is coming from me or Mark, they should either fight it or ignore it. As hard as it is to have an honest dialogue about business decisions, it is even harder to give individuals honest feedback. This is true for entry-level employees, senior leaders, and everyone in between. One thing that helps is to remember that feedback, like truth, is not absolute. Feedback is an opinion, grounded in observations and experiences, which allows us to know what impression we make on others. The information is revealing and potentially uncomfortable, which is why all of us would rather offer feedback to those who welcome it. If I make an observation or recommendation and someone reacts badly, or even just visibly tenses up, I quickly learn to save my comments for things that really matter. This is why I so admire Molly Graham's approach. Molly joined Facebook in 2008 and held a number of jobs throughout the company in communications, human resources, and mobile products. She performed extraordinarily well in all of these very different roles, not just because she is uniquely talented, but because she is always learning. One day, she and I hosted a tricky client meeting. She navigated the discussion effectively, and after the clients left, I praised her effort. She paused and said, "Thanks, but you must have ideas for me on what more I could have done." How can I do better? What am I doing that I don't know? What am I not doing that I don't see? These questions can lead to many benefits. And believe me, the truth hurts. Even when I have solicited feedback, any judgment can feel harsh. But the upside of painful knowledge is so much greater than the downside of blissful ignorance. Requesting advice can also help build relationships. At Facebook, I knew that the most important determinant of my success would be my relationship with Mark. When I joined, I asked Mark for a commitment that he would give me feedback every week so that anything that bothered him would be aired and discussed quickly. Mark not only said yes, but immediately added that he wanted it to be reciprocal. For the first few years, we stuck to this routine and voiced concerns big and small every Friday afternoon. As the years went by, Sharing honest reactions became part of our ongoing relationship. Now we do so in real time rather than waiting for the end of the week. I wouldn't suggest that all relationships need this much feedback. There is such a thing as asking for too much. But for us, it has been critically important. I have also learned the hard way that being open to hearing the truth means taking responsibility for mistakes. In my first week as chief of staff at Treasury, I had the chance to work directly with the heads of the department bureaus. There is a right and a wrong way to start a working relationship. I chose the wrong way. My first call was to Ray Kelly, who was then commissioner of the U.S. Customs Service and now serves as New York City's police commissioner. Instead of reaching out to offer assistance, I called Commissioner Kelly with a request from the secretary. The impression I made was that my job was to demand and his job was to listen. It was a mistake. Ray's response was quick and clear. Expletive, Cheryl, he explained. Just because I'm not in Larry Summers, expletive, 30-year-old brain trust doesn't mean that I don't know what I'm doing. If Secretary Summers wants something from me, tell him to, expletive, call me himself. Then he hung up the phone. I thought, this is not going well. My first week on the job, and I'd angered a man who knows a thing or two about firearms. After I stopped shaking, I realized that Commissioner Kelly had done me a huge favor. His feedback was extremely helpful and delivered in a way that I would never forget. I reassessed my outreach strategy. With the other bureau chiefs, I initiated conversation by asking what I could do to help them achieve their goals. It's no surprise that they reacted more positively and with far fewer expletives. And after I employed my "What have I done for you lately?" approach, they were far more eager to return the favor. As often as I try to persuade people to share their honest views, it is still a challenge to elicit them. When I started building my team at Google, I interviewed every candidate before we made an offer. Even when the team had grown to about 100 people, I still spoke with each finalist. One day at a meeting of my direct reports, I offered to stop interviewing, fully expecting everyone to insist that my input was an essential part of the process. Instead, they applauded. They all jumped in to explain, in unison, that my insistence on speaking personally to every candidate had become a huge bottleneck. I had no idea that I had been holding the team back and was upset that no one had told me. I spent a few hours quietly fuming, which, given that I have no poker face, was probably obvious to everyone. Then I realized that if my colleagues had kept this to themselves, I was clearly not communicating that I was open to their input. Miscommunication is always a two-way street. If I wanted more suggestions, I would have to take responsibility for making that clear. So I went back to my team and agreed that I would not interview anymore. And more important, I told them that I wanted their input early and often. Another way I try to foster authentic communication is to speak openly about my own weaknesses. To highlight just one, I have a tendency to get impatient about unresolved situations. My reaction is to push for people to resolve them quickly, in some cases before they realistically can. David Fisher and I have worked closely together for 15 years at Treasury, Google, and Facebook. He jokes that he can tell from my tone of voice whether he should bother to complete a task or if I'm about to just do it myself. I acknowledge my impatience openly and ask my colleagues to let me know when I need to chill out. By mentioning this myself, I give others permission to bring up my impatience and joke about it too. My colleagues will say to me, "Cheryl, you asked us to tell you when you get nervous and push the teams too hard. I think you're doing that now." But if I never said anything, would anyone at Facebook walk up to me and announce, "Hey, Cheryl, calm down. You're driving everyone nuts"? Somehow, I doubt it. They would think it. They might even say it to one another, but they wouldn't say it to me. When people are open and honest, Thanking them publicly encourages them to continue while sending a powerful signal to others. At a meeting with about 60 Facebook engineers, I mentioned that I was interested in opening more Facebook offices around the world, especially in one particular region. Since the group included members of the security team, I asked what they were most worried about. Without being called on, Chad Green blurted out, "Opening a Facebook office in that region." He explained why it wouldn't work and why I was dead wrong in front of the entire group. I loved it. We had never met before, and I will never forget that strong introduction. I ended the meeting by thanking Chad for his candor, and then posted the story on Facebook to encourage the rest of the company to follow his example. Mark feels the same way. At a summer barbecue 4 years ago, an intern told Mark that he should work on his public speaking skills. Mark thanked him in front of everyone, and then encouraged us to extend him a full-time job offer. Humor can be an amazing tool for delivering an honest message in a good-natured way. A recent study even found that sense of humor was the phrase most frequently used to describe the most effective leaders. I have seen humor get results so many times. After working in the Obama White House, Marnie Levine joined Facebook to run global public policy. Marnie is polished, professional, and highly competent. During her first week at her job, she needed a colleague from another team to finish drafting a few paragraphs for an upcoming congressional testimony. The colleague was dragging his heels. He kept coming to Marnie to ask questions, which she would duly answer, then she would wait, but still no paragraphs. When he came to her again with yet another question, she turned to him with a huge smile and said, "I am going to answer all of your questions. I really am. But right now, the only thing that is going to keep me from falling down on the floor and having a heart attack right in front of you is for you to get out of your chair, go back to your desk, and write the paragraphs we need for Congress." It worked beautifully. A colleague at Google, Adam Fried, and I were frustrated by someone at work who was making our jobs very difficult. I met with her several times and earnestly explained that I felt that she was second-guessing our every move and preventing progress. During each heartfelt discussion, she would listen and nod and thank me for raising the matter. I would leave feeling better. Then the situation would get worse. Adam took a totally different approach. He invited her to lunch. They met at the Google Cafe, chatted a bit, and then he looked at her and jokingly asked, "Why do you hate me?" Where I had failed repeatedly, Adam broke through. She asked why he would make that joke, which gave him a chance to explain in a way she was able to hear. Unfortunately, our sense of humor sometimes fails us when we need it most. When I get emotional, it's very hard for me to treat a problem lightly. I had been at Google about 3 months when an uncomfortable situation erupted. I had started at the company reporting to Eric Schmidt, but was transitioning to work for Omid Kordestani. During that process, Omid and I had a major misunderstanding. I went to discuss it with him, intending to explain calmly why I was upset. But as soon as I started talking, I burst into tears. I was horrified to be crying in front of my new boss, whom I barely knew, which just made more tears flow. But I got lucky. Omid was patient and reassuring, insisting, "Everyone gets upset at work. It's okay." Most women believe, and research suggests, that it is not a good idea to cry at work. It is never something that I plan to do, and is hardly recommended in the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. But on those rare occasions when I have felt really frustrated, or worse, betrayed, tears have filled my eyes. Even as I have gotten older and more experienced, it still happens every so often. I had been working at Facebook for almost a year when I learned that someone had said something about me that was not just false, but cruel. I started telling Mark about it and, despite my best efforts, started to cry. He assured me that the accusation was so untrue that no one could possibly believe it. And then he asked, Do you want a hug?
I did.
It was a breakthrough moment for us. I felt closer to him than ever before. I then recounted this story publicly, figuring that it might make it easier for others who have faced unwanted tears. The press reported the incident as, "Sheryl Sandberg cried on Mark Zuckerberg's shoulder," which is not exactly what happened. What happened was that I expressed my feelings, and Mark responded with compassion. Sharing emotions builds deeper relationships. Motivation comes from working on things we care about. It also comes from working with people we care about. To really care about others, we have to understand them, what they like and dislike, what they feel as well as think. Emotion drives both men and women and influences every decision we make. Recognizing the role emotions play and being willing to discuss them makes us better managers, partners, and peers. I did not always understand this. I used to think that being professional meant being organized and focused and keeping my personal life separate. Early on at Google, Omid and I would have a one-on-one meeting each week. I would enter his office with a typed agenda and get right to it. I thought I was being so efficient. But my colleague Tim Armstrong, who later became CEO of AOL, kindly pulled me aside one day to give me some advice. He told me that I should take a moment to connect with Omid before diving in. Since Omid and I were the only people in those meetings, it was clear who had mentioned this to Tim. I made the adjustment and started asking Omid how he was before leaping into my to-do list. It was a good lesson. An all-business approach is not always good business. It has been an evolution, but I am now a true believer in bringing our whole selves to work. I no longer think people have a professional self from Mondays through Fridays and a real self for the rest of the time. That type of separation probably never existed, and in today's era of individual expression, where people constantly update their Facebook status and tweet their every move, it makes even less sense. Instead of putting on some kind of fake all-work persona, I think we benefit from expressing our truth, talking about personal situations, and acknowledging that professional decisions are often emotionally driven. I should have learned this lesson years earlier. When I was graduating from business school in 1995, Larry Summers offered me a job at Treasury. I wanted the job desperately, but there was an issue. I did not want to move back to D.C., where my soon-to-be ex-husband lived. One of the hardest calls I've ever had to make was to tell Larry that I could not accept the job. Larry pressed me on why, and I thought about telling him that I really wanted to try consulting in Los Angeles. Instead, I opened up. I explained that I was getting divorced and wanted to move far away from D.C., which held too many painful memories. Larry argued that it was a big city, but it didn't seem big enough for me. A year later, when enough time had passed and I felt ready to return to D.C., I called Larry and asked if the opportunity was still available. It was one of the easiest calls I have ever made, in part because I had been honest the year before. If I had told Larry that I was passing on the job for professional reasons, I would have appeared impulsive when I reversed that decision. Since the real reason was personal, sharing it honestly was the best thing to do. People often pretend that professional decisions are not affected by their personal lives. They are afraid to talk about their home situations at work, as if one should never interfere with the other, when of course, they can and do. I know many women who won't discuss their children at work out of fear that their priorities will be questioned. I hope this won't always be the case. My sister-in-law, Amy Scheffler, had a college roommate, Abby Himani, who is a partner in one of Boston's most prestigious law firms. The line between personal and professional was erased for Abby when her 7-month-old daughter was diagnosed with Dravet syndrome, a rare and severe form of epilepsy. Abby explained that her mostly male partners got used to seeing her cry at the office, and their response was heartwarming.
It was as if they envisioned me as one of their own daughters and wanted to comfort me, she said. Abby insists that her public emotion improved her work situation, both by turning her colleagues into a source of support and by leading to more flexible hours. I know several men at my firm who have had similar experiences with sick children, but they didn't feel they could be as forthcoming as I was, she said. So in the end, I think my female manner of relating served me well. Not every workplace and every colleague will be as generous and caring, but I do think we are moving toward at least blurring the line between personal and professional. Increasingly, prominent thinkers in the field of leadership studies like Marcus Buckingham are challenging traditional notions of leadership. Their research suggests that presenting leadership as a list of carefully defined qualities, like strategic, analytical, and performance-oriented, no longer holds. Instead, true leadership stems from individuality that is honestly and sometimes imperfectly expressed. They believe leaders should strive for authenticity over perfection. This shift is good news for women who often feel obliged to suppress their emotions in the workplace in an attempt to come across as more stereotypically male. And it's also good news for men who may be doing the exact same thing. I had the opportunity to see the power of authentic communication in a leader firsthand when I served on the board of Starbucks. Howard Schultz was CEO of Starbucks from 1987 through 2000, and during his tenure, the company grew from just a few stores into a global retail powerhouse. Howard stepped down as CEO in 2000, and over the next 8 years, Starbucks' performance faltered. When Howard returned as CEO in 2008, he held a meeting with all of the company's global managers in New Orleans. He openly admitted that the company was in serious trouble. Then he allowed his emotions to show, tearing up as he confessed that he felt that he had let down his employees and their families. The entire company rose to the challenge. Starbucks turned around and delivered its highest revenue and earnings a few years later. Maybe someday shedding tears in the workplace will no longer be viewed as embarrassing or weak, but as a simple display of authentic emotion. And maybe the compassion and sensitivity that have historically held some women back will make them more natural leaders in the future. In the meantime, we can all hasten this change by committing ourselves to both seek and speak our truth. Chapter 7. Don't leave before you leave. A few years ago, a young woman at Facebook came to my desk and asked if she could speak to me privately. We headed into a conference room where she began firing off questions about how I balance work and family. As the questions came faster and faster, I started to wonder about her urgency. I interrupted to ask if she had a child. She said no, but she liked to plan ahead. I inquired if she and her partner were considering having a child. She replied that she did not have a husband, then added with a little laugh, "Actually, I don't even have a boyfriend." It seemed to me that she was jumping the gun, big time, but I understood why. From an early age, girls get the message that they will have to choose between succeeding at work and being a good mother. By the time they are in college, women are already thinking about the trade-offs they will make between professional and personal goals. When asked to choose between marriage and career, female college students are twice as likely to choose marriage as their male classmates. And this concern can start even younger. Peggy Orenstein, the author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, related the story of a 5-year-old girl who came home distraught from her after-school program and told her mother that both she and the boy she had a crush on wanted to be astronauts. When her mother asked why that was a problem, the little girl replied, "When we go into space together, who will watch our kids?" At 5, she thought the most challenging aspect of space travel would be dependable childcare. As I've mentioned, I'm a big believer in thoughtful preparation. Everywhere I go, I carry a little notebook with my to-do list. An actual notebook that I write in with an actual pen. In the tech world, this is like carrying a stone tablet and chisel. But when it comes to integrating career and family, planning too far in advance can close doors rather than open them. I have seen this happen over and over. Women rarely make one big decision to leave the workforce. Instead, they make a lot of small decisions along the way, making accommodations and sacrifices that they believe will be required to have a family. Of all the ways women hold themselves back, perhaps the most pervasive is that they leave before they leave. The classic scenario unfolds like this. An ambitious and successful woman heads down a challenging career path with the thought of having children in the back of her mind. At some point, this thought moves to the front of her mind, typically once she finds a partner. The woman considers how hard she is working and reasons that, to make room for a child, she will have to scale back. A law associate might decide not to shoot for partner because someday she hopes to have a family. A teacher might pass on leading curriculum development for her school. A sales representative might take a smaller territory or not apply for a management role. Often, without even realizing it, the woman stops reaching for new opportunities. If any are presented to her, she is likely to decline or offer the kind of hesitant yes that gets the project assigned to someone else. The problem is that even if she were to get pregnant immediately, she still has 9 months before she has to care for an actual child. And since women usually start this mental preparation well before trying to conceive, several years often pass between the thought and conception, let alone birth. In the case of my Facebook questioner, it might even be a decade. By the time the baby arrives, the woman is likely to be in a drastically different place in her career than she would have been had she not leaned back. Before, she was a top performer, on par with her peers in responsibility, opportunity, and pay. By not finding ways to stretch herself in the years leading up to motherhood, she has fallen behind. When she returns to the workplace after her child is born, she is likely to feel less fulfilled, underutilized, or unappreciated. She may wonder why she is working for someone, usually a man, who has less experience than she does. Or she may wonder why she does not have the exciting new project or the corner office. At this point, she probably scales her ambitions back even further, since she no longer believes that she can get to the top. And if she has the financial resources to leave her job, she is more likely to do so. The more satisfied a person is with her position, the less likely she is to leave. So the irony, and to me, the tragedy, is that women wind up leaving the workforce precisely because of things they did to stay in the workforce. With the best of intentions, they end up in a job that is less fulfilling and less engaging. When they finally have a child, the choice, for those who have one, is between becoming a stay-at-home mother or returning to a less than appealing professional situation. Joanna Strober, co-author of Getting to 50-50, credits a compelling job for her decision to return to the workforce after becoming a mother. When I first started working, there were lots of scary stories about female executives who ignored their kids or weren't home enough, she told me. Everyone in our office talked about one executive whose daughter supposedly told her that when she grew up, she wanted to be a client because they got all the attention. I found these stories so depressing that I gave up before even really starting down the partner track. However, when 5 years later I was in a job I really loved, I found myself wanting to return to work after a few weeks of maternity leave. I realized those executives weren't scary at all. Like me, they loved their kids a lot. And like me, they also loved their jobs. There are many powerful reasons to exit the workforce. Being a stay-at-home parent is a wonderful and often necessary choice for many people. Not every parent needs, wants, or should be expected to work outside the home. In addition, we do not control all of the factors that influence us, including the health of our children. Plus, many people welcome the opportunity to get out of the rat race. No one should pass judgment on these highly personal decisions. I fully support any man or woman who dedicates his or her life to raising the next generation. It is important and demanding and joyful work. What I am arguing is that the time to scale back is when a break is needed or when a child arrives, not before, and certainly not years in advance. The months and years leading up to having children are not the time to lean back, but the critical time to lean in. Several years ago, I approached an employee at Facebook to manage an important new project. She seemed flattered at first, but then became noticeably hesitant. She told me that she wasn't sure she should take on more responsibility. Obviously, something else was going on, so I quietly asked, "Are you worried about taking this on because you're considering having a child sometime soon?" A few years earlier, I would have been afraid to ask this question. Managers are not supposed to factor childbearing plans into account in hiring or management decisions. Raising this topic in the workplace would give most employment lawyers a heart attack. But after watching so many talented women pass on opportunities for unspoken reasons, I started addressing this issue directly. I always give people the option of not answering, but so far, every woman I have asked has appeared grateful for a chance to discuss the subject. I also make it clear that I am only asking for one reason: to make sure they aren't limiting their options unnecessarily. In 2009, we were recruiting Preeti Choksi to join Facebook's business development team. After we extended an offer, she came in to ask some follow-up questions about the role. She did not mention lifestyle or hours, but she was the typical age when women have children. So as we were wrapping up, I went for it. "If you think you might not take this job because you want to have a child soon, I am happy to talk about this." I figured if she didn't want to discuss it, she would just keep heading for the door. Instead, she turned around, sat back down, and said, "Let's talk." I explained that, although it was counterintuitive, right before having a child can actually be a great time to take a new job. If she found her new role challenging and rewarding, she'd be more excited to return to it after giving birth. If she stayed put, she might decide that her job was not worth the sacrifice. Preeti accepted our offer. By the time she started at Facebook, she was already expecting. 8 months later, she had her baby, took 4 months off, and came back to a job she loved. She later told me that if I had not raised the topic, she would have turned us down. Like so many women, Caroline O'Connor believed that someday she'd have to choose between career and family. That day came sooner than she expected. Caroline was finishing up at Stanford's Institute of Design when she was offered the chance to start a company at the same time that she learned she was pregnant. Her knee-jerk reaction was to think that she could not do both. But then she decided to question this assumption. "I began thinking of my dilemma as I would a design challenge," O'Connor wrote. "Rather than accepting that launching a successful startup and having a baby are utterly incompatible, I framed it as a question and then set about using tools I've developed as a designer to begin forming an answer." O'Connor gathered data from dozens of mothers about their experiences and coping mechanisms. She did field work on sleep deprivation by taking a night shift with foster infants. She concluded that with a team culture that drew support from her husband and friends, it would be possible to proceed with both. O'Connor now refers to herself as a career-loving parent, a nice alternative to working mom. "Given life's variables, I would never recommend that every woman lean in regardless of circumstances. There have been times when I chose not to." In the summer of 2006, a tiny startup called LinkedIn was looking for a new CEO, and Reid Hoffman, LinkedIn's founder, reached out to me. I thought it was a great opportunity, and after 5 years in the same position at Google, I was ready for a new challenge. But the timing was tricky. I was 37 years old and wanted to have a second child. I told Reid the truth. Regrettably, I had to pass because I didn't think I could handle both a pregnancy and a new job. His reaction was incredibly kind and supportive. He tried to talk me into it, even volunteering to work full-time at the company to support me during that period. But it was hard to see a path through. For some women, pregnancy does not slow them down at all, but rather serves to focus them and provides a firm deadline to work toward. My childhood friend, Elise Scheck, looks back fondly on being pregnant, saying she has never felt so productive. She not only worked her usual hours as an attorney, but organized her house and put 5 years of photos into albums. For others, like me, pregnancy is very difficult, making it impossible to be as effective as normal. I tried writing emails while hovering over the toilet, but the situation didn't lend itself to effective multitasking. Because I had already been through this with my first pregnancy, I knew what I was in for. I turned down Reed's offer and got pregnant and extremely nauseated a few months later. Any regrets I had about not taking that job evaporated when, about 7 months after my daughter was born, Mark offered me the opportunity to join Facebook. The timing was still not ideal. As many people had warned, and I quickly discovered to be true, having two children was more than double the work of having one. I was not looking for new challenges, but simply trying to get through each day. Still, Dave and I recognized that if I waited until the timing was exactly right, the opportunity would be gone. My decision to take the job was personal, as these decisions always are. And there were days in my first 6 months at Facebook when I wondered whether I'd made the right choice. By the end of my first year, I knew I had. For me. The birth of a child instantly changes how we define ourselves. Women become mothers, men become fathers, couples become parents. Our priorities shift in fundamental ways. Parenting may be the most rewarding experience, but it is also the hardest and most humbling. If there were a right way to raise kids, everyone would do it. Clearly, that is not the case. One of the immediate questions new parents face is who will provide primary care for a child. The historical choice has been the mother. Breastfeeding alone has made this both the logical and the biological choice. But the advent of the modern-day breast pump has changed the equation. At Google, I would lock my office door and pump during conference calls. People would ask, "What's that sound?" I would respond, "What sound?" When they would insist that there was a loud beeping noise that they could hear on the phone, I would say, "Oh, there's a fire truck across the street." I thought I was pretty clever until I realized that others on the call were sometimes in the same building and knew there was no fire truck. Busted. Despite modern methods that can minimize the impact of biological imperatives, women still do the vast majority of childcare. As a result, becoming a parent decreases workforce participation for women but not men. 43% of highly qualified women with children are leaving careers, or off-ramping for a period of time. Women who are the most likely to leave the workforce are concentrated at opposite ends of the earning scale, married to men who earn the least and the most. In 2006, only 20% of mothers whose husbands' earnings landed in the middle, between the 25th and 75th percentiles, were out of the labor force. In contrast, a whopping 52% of mothers with husbands in the bottom quarter and 40% of mothers with husbands in the top 5% were out of the labor force. Obviously, their reasons for staying home are vastly different. Mothers married to the lowest earning men struggle to find jobs that pay enough to cover childcare costs, which are increasingly unaffordable. Over the past decade, childcare costs have risen twice as fast as the median income of families with children. The cost for two children, an infant and a four-year-old, to go to a daycare center is greater than the annual median rent payment in every state in the country. Women married to men with greater resources leave for a variety of reasons, but one important factor is the number of hours that their husbands work. When husbands work 50 or more hours per week, wives with children are 44% more likely to quit their jobs than wives with children whose husbands work less. Many of these mothers are those with the highest levels of education. A 2007 survey of Harvard Business School alumni found that while men's rates of full-time employment never fell below 91%, only 81% of women who graduated in the early 2000s and 49% of women who graduated in the early 1990s were working full-time. Of Yale alumni who had reached their 40s by 2000, only 56% of the women remained in the workforce, compared with 90% of the men. This exodus of highly educated women is a major contributor to the leadership gap. While it's hard to predict how an individual will react to becoming a parent, it's easy to predict society's reaction. When a couple announces that they are having a baby, everyone says congratulations to the man and congratulations, what are you planning on doing about work, to the woman. The broadly held assumption is that raising their child is her responsibility. In more than 30 years, this perception has changed very little. A survey of the Princeton class of 1975 found that 54% of the women foresaw work-family conflict compared to 26% of the men. The same survey of the Princeton class of 2006 found that 62% of the women anticipated work-family conflict compared to only 33% of the men. 3 decades separate the studies, and still nearly twice as many women as men enter the workforce anticipating this stumbling block. Even in 2006, 46% of the men who anticipated this conflict expected their spouse to step off her career track to raise their children. Only 5% of the women believed their spouse would alter his career to accommodate their child. Personal choices are not always as personal as they appear. We are all influenced by social conventions, peer pressure, and familial expectations. On top of these forces, women who can afford to drop out of the workplace often receive not just permission, but encouragement to do so from all directions. Imagine that a career is like a marathon, a long, grueling, and ultimately rewarding endeavor. Now imagine a marathon where both men and women arrive at the starting line equally fit and trained. The gun goes off. The men and women run side by side. The male marathoners are routinely cheered on. Looking strong, on your way. But the female runners hear a different message. You know you don't have to do this, the crowd shouts. Or, good start, but you probably won't want to finish. The farther the marathoners run, the louder the cries grow for the men. Keep going, you've got this. But the women hear more and more doubts about their efforts. External voices, and often their own internal voice, repeatedly question their decision to keep running. The voices can even grow hostile. As the women struggle to endure the rigors of the race, spectators shout, "Why are you running when your children need you at home?" Back in 1997, Debbie Hemeter was a rising executive at Sara Lee, who aspired to someday lead a major corporation like her role model, Pepsi-Cola North America CEO Brenda Barnes. Even after starting a family, Debbie continued to pursue her career at full speed. Then one day, when Debbie was on a business trip, she opened her hotel door to find USA Today with the startling headline, "Pepsi Chief Trades Work for Family." The subhead elaborated, "22-year veteran got burned out." In that moment, Debbie said she felt her own ambitions shift. As Debbie told me, it seemed like if this extraordinary woman couldn't make it work, who could? Soon after, I was offered a big job at a bank, and I turned it down because my daughter was just a year old and I didn't think I could do it. Almost a decade later, I took a similar job and did it well, but I lost a decade. I actually saved that clipping and still have it today. It's a reminder of what I don't want another generation to go through. If a female marathoner can ignore the shouts of the crowd and get past the tough middle of the race, she will often hit her stride. Years ago, I met an investment banker in New York whose husband worked in public service. She told me that over the years, all of her female friends in banking quit, but because she was her family's primary breadwinner, she had to stick it out. There were days when she was jealous and wished she could leave, days when there was just too much to do or too much crap to put up with. But she did not have that option. Eventually, she landed in a position that had less crap and more impact. Now when she looks back, she is glad.